Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. My guest for this month's edition of General Talk is the number one best-selling author of Dunkirk, Joshua Levine, who talks to me about the unsung heroes and untold stories of the wartime SAS who feature in his new book. There is little that has not been written or filmed about the exploits of the legendary unit formed in 1941 by David Stirling, an officer in the Scots Guards, its purpose to strike deep behind enemy lines in the fierce fighting of the Western Desert in the North Africa campaign of the Second World War. So we began by discussing what makes the authorised illustrated history of the SAS stand out from other titles.
I think there are various things that I've tried to use to make it stand out. Most obviously, photographs. It's full of photographs, and hopefully photographs that people haven't seen before. So some of them are from the SAS archive, others are from the Imperial War Museum or from the National Archives. The point is, these are, for the most part, pictures that nobody has seen before. So on one hand, that makes the book stand out. But also, I didn't want to focus on the stories that it normally focused on. I wanted to go off-piste with this. I wanted to look behind, well, first of all, look at the people, really get as close as I could to some of these people. The famous people, David Stirling and Paddy Mayne, but also people who you won't have heard of. Who, you know, play quite a big part in this story. And tangential people who you wouldn't have thought would have any part to play in the story at all. So I didn't think there was much point in doing this book if it was just going to retread ground. So what I've wanted to do is to make it new and interesting and about the people.
One of the characters we discussed earlier was Brigadier Dudley Clark, who you described as the father of strategic deception. Tell me about Brigadier Clark.
Clark is such a fascinating man. I mean, you know, he had done all sorts of extraordinary things. I think it's quite telling that he had organized royal tournaments before the war, because he was a very theatrical, very interesting person who thought, in the modern expression, out of the box. One thing that Clark wanted to do was to fool the enemy into believing that the British had parachute troops in the Middle East. And so the way he did this, he created this whole fiction, Operation Abeam. He had found an Italian prisoner had been taken, who his diary had been full of stories about how we believe that the British have parachute troops. So when Dudley Clark saw this, he realized he could just push at an open door. If they already believed it, it was relatively easy to help them to believe it. To a greater degree. He's such an interesting character, always thinking slightly out of the box. How can I achieve my goals here?
It was Waverley, if I'm right in thinking, who was then commanding the British forces in the Western Desert in Cairo 1940, who saw Dudley Clark's potential and brought him over to Cairo. Is that correct?
He did. He brought him over to Cairo with the aim of helping him to set up some kind of deception section. And so when they read this diary, what Clark wanted to do was to create this deception to make the enemy think that there were parachute troops in the area. So he went about this in a number of ways. And one of the most important ways, one of the most important little ruses, was to get two absolutely ordinary soldiers from Palestine. And they were members of the Staffordshire Yeomanry. And he brought them to Cairo. But what he did was to dress them up in these odd uniforms, covered in parachutes, and he gave them a script. So they had to go into bars, they had to go to restaurants, they had to go to the zoo, they had to make their way up to the port side. They went all around basically talking about themselves as though they were members of this completely made up organization called the Special Air Service Brigade. The idea was that they would seem, first of all, very reticent to speak. I mean, they were covered, actually festooned in parachutes. So people would want to come up to them and ask them who they were. They had to appear as though they didn't want to speak. They didn't want to give anything away. But then perhaps they would say something, and that would lead to something else. So they would end up inadvertently speaking too much. This was quite a difficult acting exercise for two ordinary soldiers. And just before they went, Clark sent them this really quite scary memo saying, be very, very careful. If you place a foot wrong, then you risk jeopardizing this entire operation. So that's how they arrived in Cairo, with that ringing in their ears. But they did what they did. They met lots of people. Somebody patted them on the arm and said, good luck. Other people were sort of asking them, what are you up to? And by the end, they were really living this role. They were sitting down and talking to people about what they were doing. So it was a success, and it did seem to have some kind of repercussions. People did seem to start talking about it. And this idea that there were parachute troops in the area did seem to take hold. Now, one of these men had quite an unusual name. His name was Mick Gurman, and I found all his details, his photographs in the National Archive. And he came from Wolverhampton. So what I then did was to look on the internet to see if there were still any Gurmans in the area. And there was indeed a man who ran a taxi company called Gurman. So I phoned up the taxi company. They thought I was going to order a cab, but I wasn't. I actually asked, I'm sorry, did your father wasn't called Mick and he didn't take part in the Second World War? And the man was quite astonished. He said, yes, yes. And he started to tell me about him. And he said to me that he was in the SAS. And I said, was he in a fake SAS? He said, oh, no, I don't know anything about that. So anyway, did more digging in the SAS archive, found they actually had his details and his photo album in the SAS archive. And he had indeed so impressed with his acting performance that he'd then been commissioned, joined the commandos, and then joined the real SAS afterwards. And when he was in the real SAS, he never told anybody that he'd been in the fake SAS beforehand. So he joined all these legendary characters, never told them that he'd actually been in the SAS before it had even existed. And that's a great way, basically, to start the book with this story of the fake SAS and how it took hold and how it gave its name to the real SAS. Because obviously, Dudley Clark, having set up this fake, wanted to convince the enemy that it was going. So when David Sterling and Jock Lewis, really, were forming the real SAS, Clark said, well, you know, you must give them this name. And that's how they became, at the beginning, L Detachment, Special Air Service Brigade.
Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run.
Is it fair to say that really the father of all this was Winston Churchill himself, who after the defeat at Dunkirk, talked about having these butcher and bolt raiding forces, which therefore gave birth to commandos, delay force, number 8 commando.
I mean, it's always very easy to say that Churchill is at the root of everything. And, you know, it's always a bit of oversimplification. Having said that, when you study anything from this period, you know, he's always in there somewhere. You know, everything I've ever, you know, written a book about, whether it's the Royal Flying Corps or the Northern Ireland Troubles, Churchill's always there. But yes, certainly it is true that he's kick-started in that sense, the commandos. And Dudley Clark was, you know, there at the very birth of the idea for the commandos. And then, as you say, lay force. And you had these different commando units that were taken out to the Middle East and did very little. You know, they involved in a couple of failed expeditions, but were then left kicking their heels. And then you had these members, and then a lot of them, you know, these people were chosen for their initiative. They had ideas. Then you had people like Carol Mather, who was coming up with, you know, different ways of perhaps keeping the lay force going. You had George Jellicoe. And one man who had an idea was Jock Lewis. Jock Lewis had an idea for a parachute unit, a unit that effectively would parachute behind enemy lines. He organized some parachuting in the Middle East, a couple of drops, with the idea of taking it further. The authorities basically weren't interested. It actually served two purposes. I mean, it served his purpose, but it would also serve Dudley Clark's purpose, because he wanted to stage some real parachuting so that the enemy could see it. One of the people who parachuted with Jock Lewis was David Sterling. Now, Lewis did not want David Sterling to parachute with him. He didn't trust him. Lewis was a God-fearing, really quite self-denying individual. Sterling was the opposite, absolutely the opposite.
Quite shambolic, is that? I mean, but in a delightful way.
He was shambolic, but he was also, you know, he was a big drinker. He enjoyed life. He was known as the giant sloth to members of Lay Force, because he basically hadn't left in his cabin during the trip out to the Middle East. He just lay in bed all the time. So, you know, he didn't seem to be the natural person to either to help Lewis or to take the idea on himself. But he certainly was ambitious. He was clever, but he was also immensely persuasive, and he was immensely well connected. I mean, you know, he had one brother working at the British Embassy in Cairo, and he had another brother who was basically assistant to Alkin there. So
one of my favourite stories is the dinner which he attended with Winston Churchill and Bernard Montgomery, where he asked for their autographs on a piece of paper, which he then used as authority to do whatever he wants with it.
Precisely, and that's classic Sterling. I mean, you know, he's cheeky to the point of impudence. I mean, he was really in quite a lot of trouble. You know, before the SAS started, he was being investigated for basically being a shirker. So he really he needed a way of turning things around, and he found a way of turning things around by joining forces with Lewis. Now, Lewis was immensely organized. He was immensely clever. You know, he understood how the military worked, but he didn't have the wherewithal to basically set his organization up, to get it in motion. So when he parachuted, Sterling injured himself quite badly, spent time in hospital, and while he was in hospital, he basically came up with an improved version of Lewis's plan. And that's really how the SAS came about. And he also had to try and convince Lewis to join him. And at first, Lewis didn't want to join him, because he felt, this is just my plan in different wrapping, and I don't really, you know, trust him with it. This man is a sort of dilettante. But he won't change his mind. Overnight, he said he woke up in the morning and he decided to accept Sterling's proposal to go into business together. And that's really how the SAS came about.
Not wishing to debunk Stephen Knight's some great rogue heroes of the SAS, a recent TV series, the reality, of course, is very different. One of the characters you talk about is Mike Sadler, the 103-year-old Minish Medal Military Cross awarded former ash tank gunner from the Royal Artillery, who was the navigator of an old detachment SAS and then went on to be with one SAS in the Western Desert. Can you tell me a bit about him?
Sadler's a fascinating man. First of all, he's in really good health as I speak. I just adore him. He gave me some extraordinary stories that kind of, you know, gave me different angles on things that are supposedly well known. He, as you say, I mean, he was born in England, went to school in England, always adventurous. I mean, he'd gone as a, you know, when he was very young, he'd gone out to Germany, and he spent time out in Germany. And he'd seen, I think he was 35, and, you know, he'd seen what was happening in Germany. He told me all about it, the race laws that were being brought in and view of them, but also how Germany was obviously very well organized, which, you know, he said was a big, big difference to what was happening in Britain at the time. He had gone out to Rhodesia, basically, and to become a farmer after he left school. And then when the war began, he had, as you say, joined the artillery and become an anti-tank gunner. And then one day in, I think it was Cairo, found himself in a bar, which was a hangout for the Rhodesian long-range desert group. Got talking to them, they said, you know, you should really join us. It's a lot more interesting. And, you know, he had to agree. Did join a long-range desert group. That's where he became trained as a navigator. He said, you know, he absolutely adored it. He was fascinated by the fact that at night you could use a theodolite and take your position from the stars, and then during the day, you know, he would use one of the sand compasses to try and follow a route, but you were constantly being knocked off course by the desert, effectively, by the lumps and bumps and rocks and gradients of the desert. And it was, that's where it became a kind of an art form. to try and gauge instinctively how much he were being knocked off course and to try and keep on that course. And he said he absolutely loved doing it. And people talked about him. You know, he's very modest. He would say, no, there was nothing special about my navigation. But if you look at the books and you read the accounts and you talk to others, you find out that others wholly disagree and found that he really was something quite special. So in the early part of the SAS's existence in the desert, they were, well, initially, the first raid, they parachuted in, but that was a disaster. And they decided from then on, they would allow the long-range desert group to taxi them here and there, take them home again. And Sadler was one of these members of the long-range desert group who impressed Stirling so much. So when the SAS moved on to jeeps, Willie's Bantams, these strange little American vehicles that he found a few of and have become the sort of iconic image of the SAS. The SAS started driving themselves. One problem they had was that most members didn't know how to drive. You know, these were ordinary people who'd been brought up in the Depression. You know, the officers could drive, but the men couldn't. When did they ever learn to drive? So they had to very quickly teach them how to drive. Then beyond that, another problem they had was they'd been taken here, there, and everywhere by long-range desert groups, so they didn't have to worry about their own navigation. Suddenly, they were in their own jeeps driving themselves. How are they going to navigate? How are they going to get everywhere? So Sadler was poached by Stirling, basically taken. And Sadler said he never even knew he'd been poached. He didn't have a say in the matter. And just one day, he found he was in the SAS. Again, that's how Stirling turned it to work. If he wanted something, he took it. And Sadler was something that he wanted.
Bang, 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 bang goes the farmer's gun. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit.
Yes, Sadler's classic, probably, is the raid on Sidi Hanesh, where the first members went mad with machine guns, going sort of slowly around the airfield and going crazy with the machine guns. Sadler had managed to navigate 17 other jeeps through the desert. They ended up somewhere. Stirling said to Sadler, where are we? Where the hell are we? We're in the middle of nowhere. Sadler said, I think the airfield is a mile ahead. And just at that moment, the landing lights hold on. And there they were, exactly where Sadler has said they would be. And that was the moment that really made him. I mean, I think one other member called it his finest hour. So he had this reputation for being a very great navigator, somebody they could rely on. And that trust, you know, counts for so much.
You talk about how David Stirling took what he wanted and got what he wanted. One of the people who he wanted was Captain Randolph Churchill, MBE, who was Winston Churchill's son. What was the aim behind that? And what was the effect?
It's an interesting one, this, because Randolph very much wanted to be a part of the SAS. He wanted to have an exciting existence. He wanted to be courageous. And in fact, he was courageous. He was, you know, he's a very interesting man because he once said, I don't particularly get scared. I'm not imaginative enough to be scared, which is quite an admission to make. He was being sidelined in the sorts of jobs that he wasn't particularly interested in doing. He sort of dog working behind the scenes and he wanted to be involved in the action. The trouble was he was immensely unfit. He was a liability in that if he was captured, he would be an enormous morale boost for the enemy. But he wanted to be involved. And David Stirling also wanted him to be involved in the SAS, not because of anything that he could physically do or could bring to the unit. What he could do was become a direct line to Randolph's father, to Winston Churchill. And once, if you had Winston Churchill on your side, then that really did, you know, that made you an individual or as a unit or as an organization. You know, he was the most important man in the country. And Stirling knew that. So to bring Randolph on side actually was, you know, quite a coup. So he didn't bring Randolph in. Randolph wanted to be involved in raids from the off. In fact, he was only involved in one particular raid.
Benghazi 1942, wasn't it?
Benghazi 1942, when they basically traveled into Benghazi in what was known as the Blitz Buggy, which was their little truck, and they travelled in. Fitzroy MacLean was a linguist, or supposedly a linguist, so he was able to sort of talk their way in. They meant to do quite a lot of sabotage. They did none whatsoever, or none effectively. The inflatable boats that they brought, both of them, failed. So they ended up really holed up in a house. And basically, across the road, I think, from the SS headquarters. So, you know, if they had known that they had the British Prime Minister's son in the house opposite, goodness only knows. Like, what an extraordinary little event. They also, you know, they were marching around in the dark, and nobody expected them to be there. So at one point, they were marching along, and an entire sort of phalanx of Italian troops started marching with them. So you had this extraordinary, probably never to be repeated unit of British and Italians all marching together. The Italians not knowing who they were marching alongside, and they had to get rid of them at one point. They eventually managed to leave. They managed to get out safely, but then they had a car accident on the way back, and a number of people were injured, including Randolph. Randolph was really quite badly injured and hurt his back, and that's why he never did anything again with the SS. But what he did do, the important thing, was he reported back to his father. He sent his father back a huge report that basically made the SAS out to be this incredible organization, this you know, that exactly what the country needed. Winston just ate it up. So there was a lot of play with Randolph. He certainly wanted to be in the heart of things, and for a short time in the SAS he was, and you know, he was also able to excite his father about the SAS, and that did the SAS a lot of practical good.
Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run.
We've talked of Brigadier Dudley Clark, we've talked of Mike Sadler, we've talked of Randolph Churchill. But two other characters that I'd like to discuss are, first of all, the Padre, Reverend Fraser Tusky, MC, who was a Scots Presbyterian minister who, like Sadler, had also been to Germany before the war. Why was he so important?
Well, he arrived before D-Day, before they went out to France, I think very nervous that he would have no role to play whatsoever. He couldn't imagine. You know, he was dropped into France, and he landed in a tree, got stuck in the tree. He fell 40 feet and threw up on the ground. That was his introduction to the France. He arrived in with hymn books and, you know, he had a silk altar cloth. He had an oak cross with him, communion vessels. You know, this is how he landed in France. He was a very strange addition to the SAS. And more, and you know, when he met Paddy Mayne, you know, Mayne was quite bemused as to, you know, what you know, good he could possibly do. And certainly that was his own view. What good will I do? People, they're going to be so busy. They're going to be so taken up with just staying alive. You know, what role can I play? And so he was quite delighted to discover that he was very, very valuable to the SAS men in France. He landed as part of Operation Houndsworth, which was led by Bill Fraser, another very, very interesting man who's unsung, never really gets his due. He arrived, and his plan was to, you know, give little services around and about. And when he gave the first one to service 30 men around the campsite, what he discovered was they really, really wanted to be there. They wanted to come along. What he realized beyond that was that the reason they wanted to come was because he offered them a kind of normality, a kind of reason to be there. He wasn't just a luxury. He wasn't just, you know, some sort of strange addition that put them in danger. He reminded them of their lives at home, and he reminded them of their purpose in being there. They weren't just there for their own amusement. They were there to help to win the war, to get back to something familiar or something better than they had before. And he noticed that, you know, their existence, the way that they lived among these men, lived among themselves, he describes it as watching real, true religion being lived, men helping each other in a way that they didn't during peacetime. And what I think he discovered was that not so much that, wasn't it that war did make people afraid, but the problem wasn't that war made people afraid. The problem was that peace, in a sense, didn't make people too little afraid, too secure, too closed off from each other. And he, what he discovered was this world where people were actually properly engaged with each other. And then when he gave his services and when he talked about religion, were engaged, properly engaged with him. He was very, very valuable to them. And he did guard duty and he did other things. The question arose, should he carry a gun? His instinct was he probably should, because he'd be letting people, how could he do guard, proper guard duty without? The men said no. They didn't want him carrying a gun. He was a reminder of why they were there. He was something from the other world, the real world, the world they were fighting for. And they wanted him to remain there. They didn't want him to carry a gun. I find that very, very interesting. And I find it very interesting that he is a kind of representative of, you know, there were various people within the SAS. He's one. Mike Sadler, in fact, is another, although he did do a lot of fighting. The doctor, Malcolm Pleydell, and the doctor after him, Gunn. These are others, people who didn't fight, weren't there to fight, but who were immensely valuable, almost worshipped by the men who did fight, because these were the people who allowed them to do their fighting, who kept them safe in different ways, and allowed them to do what it was that they did in their different ways. So Sadler would get them to where they had to do their fighting. Dr. Pleydell would keep them fit and healthy, or try to keep them fit and healthy to do their job. And in a more subtle but very important way, the Padre allowed them to allow them the space, the sort of mental space that you like, will do their job. But Paddy Mayne has always struck me as a pragmatist, really. You know, he was certainly a combative man, shall we say. You know, he would always up for a fight of different kinds. When he was sober, actually, he was really a very quiet man, very surprisingly gentle man. When he'd had a drink, he could be monstrous. But he was also the man who kept the SAS going after David Sterling was captured in Tunisia. Mm-hmm. And there is this extraordinary moment where, this is in North Africa, where Mayne and Sterling get drunk together. And they open up to each other. And Sterling, it turns out, was an artist. Sterling had lived in Paris in the 1930s on the left bank, and his dream, it was actually more than a dream. I mean, he genuinely wanted to be an artist, and discovered to his absolute immense disappointment that he wasn't technically good enough. And he said it was the biggest disappointment of his life. And he then went off. He all this energy that he was putting into being an artist, he turned into a physical pursuit. He wanted to be the first man to climb Everest. And then from there, that's how then the war started, and all that energy then ended up being put into the SAS. Big frustration that he wasn't an artist. Now, Paddy Mayne opened up to Sterling that night that his big frustration was that he wanted to be a writer. He loved poetry. He used to recite poetry in the mess. That was his passion. But he couldn't do that. So you had this extraordinary, this sort of revelation, the two big driving forces. You know, a lot of the existence of the SAS were really driven by the fact that they were failed artists. You know, quite apart from what the parallel is, Germany and a failed artist, but you know, the fact is that you know, this is a very strong image of the, you know, these men who were so determined and achieved so much and created this legend around themselves.
We mentioned earlier of Dr. Malcolm Pleydell, MC, who was the medical officer for the 3rd Battalion Corps from Gaza in the Western Desert in 1942, and then joined L Detachment of the SAS later that same year, going on to be with 1 SAS after that. His book was Born of the Desert by Malcolm James, written under the pseudonym of Malcolm James. You talk of the effect he had on the regiment and kept them all going back in the Western Desert. What was his key attribute, you think, that kept the machine running?
Oh, I think he was a very, very effective doctor. And as I say, he was very important to people to have a good doctor. You know, people were in constant physical danger, and to have somebody that they could trust who might be able to put them back together or keep them alive was hugely important. But beyond that, I think what he's a really interesting man because he left not only his memoir, but letters to his fiancée and lots of documents, a diary in the Imperial War Museum. If you go through all of these things from throughout his time, from the time of the Coldstream Guards, as well as the SAF, he is constantly worried that he's not up to it. He's terrified of his own fears and of showing his fears up in front of his colleagues. And so when he joins the SAS, he's immensely impressed by the caliber of person. The way he views them is that they're not showing at all. You know, they're not boastful. They're immensely strong and strong-minded and courageous, but they simply get on with the job. And that's, he starts to try and live up to them and not to betray his own fears. And so in a way, he's quite ashamed of a lot of his own behavior, a lot of his own fears. And in a way, he shames himself into winning a military crown.
These are like Cromwell's russet-coated captains who know what they love and love what they know. Your book covers the entire illustrated history of the SAS throughout the Second World War and released by William Collins in early May.
And yes, and as I say, I've tried to tell lots of stories about lots of people that you wouldn't ordinarily hear. So I'll leave you with one that I find quite, really interesting, that David Stirling was traveling in the desert one day and he saw a truck in the distance. He was in his Jeep. He chased it and caught up with it. And two men got out and in foreign accents started to talk. Stirling asked who they were. And they said, "We're members of the SAS," which Stirling found very funny. And, my unit has become so famous, so celebrated, so important that the enemy are now trying to pass themselves off as us. So it gave him a real sense of importance. Except it turned out that these members of the SAS really were members of the SAS. They were members of the South African Survey who were there behind enemy lines. Wonderful story of how hubris can creep up on you at any time. And, however important you are, not to take yourself too seriously. And that is David Stirling's moments of hubris.
On that very note, Josh Loreen, thank you so much for being my guest on General Talk for this month.
Thank you very much.
And my thanks once again to Joshua Levine for being this month's guest on General Talk. SAS, the Illustrated History of the SAS, published by William Collins, is available for pre-order now, either online or in bookshops, prior to release on the 11th of May. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please visit our extensive archive of programmes and interviews at soldierscharity.org. And as the one of Lance Shelton, under the musical direction of Bert Ambrose and his orchestra, serenades us out with Lily Marlena, the regimental slow march of the Special Air Service, from me, Harry Buckle, in deepest Dorset, keep smiling through. Thank you for listening. Farewell.
Underneath the lantern by the barricade, darling, I remember the way you used to wait.
Musical excerpts were from Run, Rabbit, Run, written by Noel Gay and Ralph Butler. Music by Noel Gay, sung by Bud Flanagan and Chesney Allen, accompanied by the Harry Bidgood Orchestra. With studio editing by Steve Camper at Creative Radio, this has been a GameCube production for ABF, the Soldier Charity.